but to begin this evening.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
We've all experienced no-frills air travel, in abundance in all probability, but when air travel to the public began, it was an exclusive experience, open only to the elite who could afford it. And Pan American, or Pan Am, was the airline that most embodied the glitz and glamour of flying.
Welcome aboard. Welcome aboard the spacious cabin, attractively decorated, air-conditioned but draft-free. This is the atmosphere on a Jet Clipper flight. Delicious food adds to the enjoyment. It's prepared in four simultaneously operating galleys where dishes can be cooked in five-minute ovens.
That clip there from a 1958 promotional film for the Pan Am Boeing 707 jet service. A new book, Food and Aviation in the 20th Century, The Pan American Ideal, reveals the most fascinating history of one of the most, if not the most, luxurious of airlines, Pan Am. The book focuses in particular on its gourmet food, which, as we'll hear, was central to the carrier's success. It's a story told by former flight attendants, warts and all, and shows that there's more to the so-called golden age of air travel than you might expect. And the author is Dr. Bryce Evans. Bryce, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Hello there, Miles. How are you?
Now, I'm intrigued by one thing. You're an academic historian. This doesn't come across as something that is a very obvious topic for an academic historian to be approaching. So I'm intrigued to know what brought you to this subject in the first place.
Well, Miles, I specialise in political history, but also the political history of food. And what attracted me to Pan Am, as you said there, is the razzmatazz, the glamour, the exoticism, the fact that it was, as is often remarked, the second most recognisable American brand behind Coca-Cola. But not only that, I think politically, Pan Am is important because it effectively functioned throughout the 20th century as an arm of state for the United States. So as well as achieving many of the firsts in commercial aviation, it acts, I think, as a deniable arm of state, really, for the United States of America. And I suppose, secondly, I'm interested in how that translated in terms of soft power, especially in the Cold War context. And that led me down the food route. And of course, that led inexorably to airline food, something everyone seems to have an opinion on, usually bad, but which completely lacks an academic history, and which Pan Am, to give it its due, was the first to pioneer airline food as we know it, perhaps not love it today.
Now, in those early days of flying, from the 1920s to the 1940s, flying was obviously the domain of elite, wealthy, white, almost exclusively men, I would imagine. When did that start to change?
That starts to change, Miles, post-war, when the aviation industry opens up. You're right, in the early days, it's for a sort of waspish elite, a white male elite, really. And that's reflected in the food that's offered. It's stolid American fare. But when the industry opens up post-war and more people start flying, airlines like Pan Am are forced to open up and pioneer things like business class and economy class. And that happens really from the 50s onwards, but also into the 70s, I think, when flying becomes a mass phenomenon, when you have this sort of now familiar herd experience of the 747. But certainly after the war, things start to open up and airlines like Pan Am have to start catering towards the common man or woman.
And at what stage does airline food begin to become more sophisticated, as it were?
I think that it starts to become more sophisticated when there's a serious collaboration with chefs, with proper chefs. Like I mentioned, Pan Am pioneers airline food, but it does so in the mid-40s. And that's the first use of pre-packaged, frozen, flash-frozen food, reheated in aluminium containers, and then heated in ovens in the air. But in the early days, that's quite a not a very palatable experience. There's a lot of cardboard and cellophane involved. And it comes to the 50s, and an interesting little episode, which industry insiders called the Sandwich War. And it's when there's a tribunal taken internationally by Pan Am and some of the other big muscular American airlines against the European competition, because everyone had agreed that in economy class, sandwiches could only be offered. So the distinction was between first class, where it's hot food, and economy class, where it's sandwiches. The problem is the Scandinavians especially start producing all these kind of lovely, lavish, very garnished sandwiches in economy class. And that makes the American competition jealous. So there's a landmark ruling that sandwiches can't be overly garnished. And as everyone comes to recognize, that's incredibly fastidious. And it makes the big American airlines like Pan Am actually say, well, look, if we are going to embrace airline food, we really need to do it properly. We need to get chefs on board, and we need to get Michelin-starred French chefs on board and start opening up good food, not just to those in first class, but those in economy class as well.
Okay, make me salivate, if you would, for a while, and tell me something about the kind of food that first-class passengers would eat on Pan Am in the post-war period after this collaboration has taken place with French chefs.
Well, I was very lucky when researching this book, Miles. You know, as historians, we're usually confined to dusty archives, but I went to interview some former flight attendants in Miami, all of whom were female in their 70s and 80s, who invited me to a recreation of a Pan Am first class meal on the ground in the house of one of them. Slightly surreal experience. They were still all dressed in their Pan Am uniforms. but in we went, and we were seated at the table, and we had an 8-course extravaganza. So we're talking caviar, soup, a range of entrees, a cheese dish, dessert dish, a fruit dish, and obviously in the middle, the sort of centerpiece, which was back in the day, you'd get this in the air, the meat being carved from rolling carts to order. Each course, of course, accompanied by a wine or a liqueur specially chosen. So people often ask me, you know, airline food, really, you can't have experienced it, you know, good airline food, or have you experienced airline food? Well, I always say the best airline food I've experienced was actually on the ground, served up authentically by former stewardesses, and it was an Epicurean feast.
And I think it was literally another level, because with the 747, the first class passengers were upstairs, weren't they?
They were indeed. And this speaks to, again, the man behind Pan Am, a guy called Juan Tripp, who has a sort of Hispanic sounding name, but Tripp was really from that Gilded Age kind of Great Gatsby style world of the sort of wealthy American East Coast, came from a fairly wealthy stockbroking background, did Tripp. But Tripp was also, as well as being having very good connections as a Yale man, he was a Navy man. And one of the things he wanted to replicate in the air was the ambience of dining at sea. And so he was always trying to convince Boeing engineers to build essentially a big cruise liner in the skies. He wanted several, not just one story, but several stories. And the engineers were always saying to him, well, this isn't safe in terms of emergency disembarkation. You can't have really more than one story. But he gets his dream with the sort of limited double-decker of the 747, which, as you'll know, has the famous upper bulge, which then on Pan Am flights becomes the famous restaurant. So that's where the first-class guests are accommodated. And like a normal restaurant, you have to make a reservation, but it was lavish stuff. The flight attendants themselves could be quite mischievous in terms of seating arrangements. Often they'd seat people who might not necessarily get on alongside each other, perhaps Arab diplomats and Israeli diplomats, that kind of thing. So it had that real ambience, that glamour, that sort of upper story, sort of razzmatazz to it.
And there was a lot of scientific research that went into their menu. Something I was completely unaware of, I have to say, is that our taste buds behave differently at altitude.
Even on the most basic no-frills service, you might get a packet of peanuts thrown at you. And that calming ritual of chewing something salty, again, Pan Am developed that with NASA, in the 60s. They associate the first people in space with the sort of calming ritual of chewing and saltiness as well. When you're at altitude, your taste buds are impaired, and they're impaired by the altitude, but also the pressure and the lack of humidity in the cabin. So you'll probably notice when you fly long haul and you get these options these days, it's usually quite salty, quite heavy sauces, quite heavily flavoured sauces. And the wines you get as well, they soon realise that some of the best noble wines don't taste great in the air. Instead, it's sometimes fruitier, cheaper wines that taste better in the air because your taste buds are desensitized.
Now, the flight attendants actually did some of the cooking themselves in the air, which must have been highly problematic at times. I think eggs in particular were a problem, weren't they?
Yes, every flight attendant that you interview, Miles, has an egg story. They used to prepare eggs to order in first class, so however you wanted your eggs, you know, scrambled, omelette, poached, whatever, that was their role. But of course, when you had the bumps and turbulence, that could cause problems. And there are some wonderful stories I was able to glean in the book of stewardesses who ended up getting caked in eggs from sort of head to foot. So it was quite an occupational hazard at the time. But it reflects the fact that Pan Am really did educate their flight attendants in the provenance of food, in cooking. A lot of the women who were flight attendants with Pan Am went there from fairly working class backgrounds and came out not only speaking a second language, which was a requirement, but also being able to cook and being able to cook under pressure. Of course, the sort of dark side of that was, in some ways, it was a crash course, a boot camp into how to be a good housewife and serve food under pressure, which is there are some sort of darker elements behind the sort of rose-tinted nostalgic appeal of Pan Am. But they did, at the time, have to cook. It was eggs that were cooked to order and fresh, as well as the heated, pre-frozen meals.
And did the pilots benefit from this wonderful first-class cuisine? Did pilots and co-pilots, for example, eat the same meal as first-class passengers?
Well, I interviewed, I think, around about 30 former flight attendants of Pan Am. A couple of them brought up this infamous incident, which they were all familiar with. Again, it's the sort of insider tale. In 1970, a flight from Copenhagen, a Pan Am flight, Copenhagen to New York, during which nearly everybody on board had the prawn, with disastrous effects. You can imagine what that looks like when there was an outbreak of food poisoning. The plane was actually met by a fleet of ambulances when it got back to JFK. But thankfully, as is per the regulation, one of the pilots had not had the prawn because they're not allowed to eat the same dish. So thankfully, someone was able to fly the plane while everybody was wretchedly sick.
You, as you say, when you researched the book, you met a lot of flight attendants. How positive were they in their 70s and 80s still about the Pan Am experience?
They were incredibly loyal and praising of the company. And it was quite amazing to me that that was still the case, because, you know, this is 30 years after the bankruptcy and collapse of Pan Am. When Pan Am collapsed, they took everything with them, from uniforms to swizzle sticks to the crockery, to the ware, to even toothpicks, which were recreated for me at this slightly bizarre dinner that I went to. But it shows an amazing company loyalty. And again, it speaks to the fact that they felt that Pan Am was effectively an arm of state, and really that they had done the state some service. And that didn't just extend to missions in terms of US conflicts like Vietnam, but also to the innovation you mentioned, Miles. That, you know, they pioneer Pan Am hydroponics, which is the growing of wheat in aquatic environments on the atolls in the Pacific, Wake and Midway. That's critical to US expansion, you know, against the Japanese in the 40s. They pioneer all kinds of things. I mentioned the space program with NASA, the mini bottle of wine, which we all take for granted on flights and in hotel rooms. That's a Pan Am invention to cater to their Hispanic customers at the time. So there was a real loyalty to the company, a feeling, like I say, that Pan Am had done the state some service, and a sort of still an unwillingness to believe that the American government had allowed the company to collapse in 1991. Such had been its significance and its cultural power throughout the 20th century.
But did they not experience a lot of condescension, a lot of sexism, a lot of drunkenness and a lot of entitlement, I suppose?
Oh, absolutely. If you can imagine, you know, the now familiar herd experience of a big plane consisting, especially towards the upper reaches of the plane, of VIPs, perhaps, or people who are flying first class, maybe for the first time, all pretty drunk. I mean, we forget these days, there's so many audiovisual distractions in the air these days. Back in the day, you know, eating and drinking was really the only thing to do. And they did, unfortunately, these women have to experience a lot of drunken groping, sexism, condescension. There are some horrendous hiring notes I was able to uncover in the Pan Am archives in Miami, in which women are turned down on the most ridiculous reasons in terms of physical appearance. People would be selected to serve with Pan Am because of how their hands appeared. And again, there was a thinly veiled racism there. The company over-recruited Japanese and Japanese-American women and under-recruited African-Americans. They also, a lot of the flight attendants I interviewed, kind of resented the pilots, who they regarded, the term they use is sky gods, for their patronizing attitude. Remember, a lot of these guys flying Pan Am would have been former combat veterans themselves. And there were some wonderful stories attached to that. But again, the guile and the resilience of these women meant that none of them really viewed themselves as victims per se. And there was a couple of great stories. There was one story I was told by one flight attendant, which, again, this is from the 60s. And it goes to show that charm, but also the element of patrician charm in flying back then. They were flying from New York to London, and one of these sky gods, a man of Irish-American descent, the pilot, decided he wanted to pop in to Shannon for an Irish breakfast. So he promptly landed the plane, made up an excuse to the passengers, and marched them all off, and they had their full Irish on lovely white linen tablecloth, and then got back on the plane an hour later. And it shows to you that degree of patrician charm, but also huge condescension from the pilots. And one of them had a story about a pilot who was particularly bullying towards her and demeaning. And one day she decided to get her own back by all the flight attendants at that time carried eye drops with them, because everyone would be smoking on board. And these eye drops, when placed into the captain's coffee, had a tremendous laxative effect. So that was her revenge on the pilot there. Again, and not a story for the faint-hearted or those with a fear of flying, but that was typical of the kind of guile and resilience that these women had. It was a very short working life. A lot of them only lasted maybe 2 or 3 years before they either married a wealthy passenger or a pilot, actually. But where there was a will, there was a way. And a lot of these women had wonderful stories about all kinds of things, smuggling, alcohol, drugs. And you can imagine, you know, with the long layovers at the time, there was, sex and partying were all part of it as well. Although they did all have a disdain for the sort of oversexed image of the flight attendant, now popular in sort of popular culture. Pan Am was a sort of, you know, liked to think of itself as above all that. You know, while competitor airlines had it, their stewardesses in hot pants, Pan Am's skirts were very much below the knee. They very much viewed themselves, these women, as a sort of airborne elite, and still had that reverence for the company that had sort of given them that status.
There are a number of stories of condescending and obnoxious behaviour, but there's one particular incident involving a certain American president, isn't there? Tell us what happened there.
Yes, it's the year was 1971, and this flight attendant, it was then a very young woman of 21. It was her first flight. She was a little nervous, from JFK to London. As the plane was taxiing, she went around first class. And again, Pan Am back in the day, you're talking VIPs, you're talking rock stars, royalty, occasionally presidents. But she was going through first class, taking the orders of a lot of whom were famous people. One youngish person who she didn't recognize refused to even acknowledge her when she asked for his food order. She came back a second time, he refused to acknowledge her. Then when the food was served, he got very agitated and angry because he wanted the prime rib of beef. And she said, "I'm very sorry, sir, but you ignored me before. Do you know who I am? I could buy every seat on this plane and all the rest. I'm sorry, sir, I can't help you." Thought nothing of it, and then is called into Pan Am headquarters in Miami 2 weeks later in front of a management board who are holding a solicitor's letter from said individual demanding she be sacked for her lack of professionalism. And thankfully, on that occasion, the Pan Am managers sided with her against this sort of obstreperous individual. And that was none other than Donald Trump, then aged 25, a 25-year-old businessman. But in fairness to Donald Trump, that kind of attitude was fairly par for the course, the kind of thing that a lot of these women encountered on quite a frequent basis.
Well, Bryce, the book shows there's much more to the history of air travel than meets the eye, certainly worthy of the attention of an historian, no doubt about that. The book is called Food and Aviation in the 20th Century, The Pan-American Ideal. It's published by Bloomsbury, and you've got a discount available for our listeners, and we'll put those details on our website. The author is Dr. Bryce Evans. Bryce, many thanks for joining us on the History Show this evening.
Many thanks, Miles.